Great. Well, I really appreciate seeing so many people here. I will pretend that it's not the food that, anyway, I know it's a busy time of year. There's lots to be done, so I appreciate your coming. I think it's better for me to stand here, right, so that I'm not, okay. We'll see how I can do this. A quick survey of the philosophical literature on responsibility will immediately reveal that the word responsibility is used in a multitude of ways for a multitude of purposes. Is this, can you hear through this? It's okay, it's a little unsettling, but that's fine. The word responsibility is frequently invoked in the context of inquiries into the causes of things. What is responsible for that clump of dead trees? Was it an avalanche or a storm or an infestation of beetles? What is responsible for the smile on your face? A good grade, a new friend, or the overdue sunny weather? This causal use of the term is often contrasted with another, and as it might be thought, deeper sense of responsibility. I'm still figuring this out. That's intended when one wants to know not only what caused an event or state of affairs, but whether anyone, and if so who, deserves blame or credit for it, or whether the event reflects something about the individuals who had a role in its occurrence that would make punishment or reward, condemnation or gratitude, or perhaps admiration appropriate. The contrast between these two senses of responsibility is often marked with the labels of causal and moral responsibility, respectively. For the most obvious illustrations of the distinction are ones in which it is the legitimacy or appropriateness of moral judgments and attitudes that are at issue. One wouldn't blame, or at least not morally blame, an avalanche or even a horde of beetles for killing the trees. They do not deserve punishment, nor would indignation towards them be appropriate. If a camper carelessly dropped a cigarette that started a forest fire, on the other hand, that would be another story. Similarly, it seems one would not credit, or at least not morally credit, the sunshine for one's good mood, but if someone had gone out of her way to benefit you, a certain kind of gratitude and praise might be appropriate. Philosophical interest in what is typically called moral responsibility also has a wide range of sources and is linked to a correspondingly wide range of issues. Since moral praise and especially moral blame have serious consequences, it is a matter of great importance to know when and under what conditions the relevant moral judgments and attitudes are deserved. A less obviously practical, but still clearly philosophical reason for being interested in this kind of responsibility, though, is the thought that responsibility is somehow connected with what makes us distinctively human. For it seems that humans, and only humans, at least among the creatures with whom we are currently in contact, can be appropriate bearers of the kinds of attitudes and judgments we might hold toward the careless camper as opposed to the beetles. And it doesn't seem unreasonable to think that that fact is reflective of something important about ourselves. It's this sort of interest, an interest that is in the connection between our status as responsible agents and what sets us apart from other animals and at least present-day machines, that leads me to my topic today. For I suspect that the tendency to identify the sense of responsibility that might be illuminating in this context with specifically moral responsibility leads us to overemphasize certain aspects of our psychologies and to neglect the importance of others. For this reason, I want to look at what appears to be instances of responsibility that are akin to instances of moral responsibility in being more than and deeper than causal responsibility, but that are concerned with judgments and attitudes that are not particularly or essentially moral. I want specifically to look at a range of phenomena that suggests that there is such a thing as aesthetic responsibility. By aesthetic responsibility, I mean to refer to a kind of deep but non-moral responsibility that an artist may have for the aesthetic qualities of his or her artworks. that there is such a thing. Sorry. That there is such a thing is suggested by several kinds of experience. Consider first the following examples. You have a friend who is an aspiring painter whose work is largely non-representational. You walk into his studio one day and are struck by a canvas still on the easel. You're inclined to think it is the best thing he's ever done. But before you get beyond your initial wow, he says, "Oh, that's just a mistake. I knocked some paint cans over on the canvas and haven't gotten around to cleaning it off yet." Or suppose that you read a short story that impresses you for its ability to succeed on two levels. Read straight, it has an interesting point, decent characters, and a sensible message. But certain details call to mind a Greek legend that allow you to interpret it also as a wry commentary on an ancient tale. The protagonist is named Penelope, let's say, and the story concerns her way of handling some overly aggressive suitors. Now, imagine your reaction when you discover that the parallels to Homer are purely accidental. In fact, the author has never heard of the Odyssey, and she named her heroine after Penelope Cruz. Both these cases, as I understand them, you initially are inclined to credit the artist, but reasonably withdraw your credit upon learning that the qualities in the art you admired were merely accidental. Although the artist in each case remains causally responsible for the artwork, he spilled the paint after all, and she wrote the story, neither are aesthetically responsible for the qualities that made you admire the art. The fact that in these examples we find it natural to withdraw credit highlights the fact that in more typical cases, we give credit. Other things equal, we take it for granted that the features of an artwork that make it good, that is, that make it beautiful, interesting, moving, insightful, and so on, are due to the artist. They are not independent of the artist's aesthetic vision and skill. But my interest in aesthetic responsibility is not restricted to the questions of whether artists deserve credit or its opposite for the aesthetic qualities of their artworks. At least as important is the appropriateness of a range of judgments and attitudes that are not solely or primarily evaluative. Most of us, when we respond to art, do not just judge them on a scale of aesthetic excellence, insofar as we do this at all. We like some art, some music, some novels more than others. And in many cases, the way we feel about the art gives rise to, or is perhaps inseparable from, feelings or attitudes towards the artists. I love Henry James, but not James Joyce. Matisse, but not Picasso. Even though I readily admit that the artistic excellence of the artists I prefer is no greater than that of the ones who leave me cold. It is not just credit that I give the ones who are my favorite, it is also a kind of affection. A little cheesy, I know. Yeah. There is, then, an emotional aspect to the attitudes many of us have toward our favorite authors, composers, and filmmakers. In some people, it fuels an interest in the biographies of these artists. In others, like me, as it happens, it explains a reluctance to learn about the rest of the artist's life for fear of spoiling or complicating the image that supports one's positive feelings. There are fan clubs, or more formally named societies, for artists ranging from Smokey Robinson to Chopin, from A.A. Milne to Anthony Trollope. And I suspect that most of the members of such organizations would describe their attitudes to their subjects in warmly personal terms. These attitudes seem to me of a piece with the sorts of attitudes the philosopher P.F. Strawson discusses in Freedom and Resentment. Wanting to bring out the close connection between our practices of holding people morally responsible for their actions and our tendency to regard them as appropriate objects of such attitudes as gratitude and resentment, Strawson contrasts these reactive attitudes, like gratitude and resentment, with the objective attitude. To adopt the objective attitude to another human being, Strawson writes, is to see him perhaps as an object of social policy, as something certainly to be taken account, perhaps precautionary account of, to be managed or handled or cured or trained, perhaps simply to be avoided. The objective attitude, he continues, may be emotionally toned in many ways, but not in all ways. It may include repulsion or fear. It may include pity or even love, though not all kinds of love. It cannot include the range of reactive feelings and attitudes which belong to involvement or participation with others in interpersonal human relationships. It cannot include resentment, gratitude, forgiveness, anger, or the sort of love which two adults can sometimes be said to feel reciprocally for each other. As Strawson notes, we can take the objective attitude towards any individual, at least for a limited time, but there are some kinds of individuals about whom we think that only the objective attitude is appropriate. Lower animals, very young children, and machines presumably belong to this category, as do adult human beings with certain severe forms of mental illness or incapacity. Strawson's focus, like that of most philosophers who write on freedom and responsibility, is on moral responsibility and on the moral or near-moral attitudes that are reactions to the good or ill will one person exhibits towards another. But insofar as he includes the sort of love which two adults can sometimes be said to feel reciprocally for each other in his list of reactive attitudes, he suggests that the moral and near-moral attitudes are part of a larger set. For the basis for such love is hardly limited to the degree to which the parties show goodwill to each other. Whom we love and how our loving relationships go may have as much to do with the individual's senses of humor, their responses to nature, or their political engagement. It seems to me that the attitudes of love, affection, or alternatively of chilliness or distaste that one may have toward an artist on the basis of her artwork falls into this broader range. Indeed, it seems easy to imagine a person literally falling in love with a poet or painter on the basis of his poetry or painting, for better or worse, I might add, and to see how an already established loving relationship can suffer as a result of how the one responds to the other's art. In any case, it seems that the tendency to form attitudes of affection or distaste toward an artist on the basis of her artwork is premised on assumptions about the kind of creature the artist is in ways significantly similar to the way our paradigmatic reactive attitudes are conditioned. If one learned that a cherished painting had been painted by an elephant, or that a musical composition one admired had been produced by a machine, I suspect that any tendency one had to love the artist would spontaneously disappear. Insofar as our tendency to resent or feel grateful to another for his actions is indicative of our taking him to be morally responsible, then, I suggest that our tendency to feel affection or distaste for an artist on the basis of her artworks is a sign that we take her to be aesthetically responsible as well. Although I hope and expect that my discussion so far has called up experiences that will be familiar to most of you, I also expect that some will be skeptical of my interpretation of these phenomena, and that others, even if they agree with such experiences, even if they agree that such experiences reflect a tendency to hold artists aesthetically responsible, will think that the tendency should be suppressed rather than validated. My claim that we have reactive attitudes towards artists on the basis of their artworks will not resonate with everyone. Some will not find in themselves any feelings towards the artists of the works they admire or despise. When they watch a movie or look at a painting or listen to music, they will say, they focus on the artwork and don't give the artist a moment's thought. Though they might have a favorite painter, composer, or director, They take that to mean only that the artist in question is a reliable creator of work that they feel confident they will enjoy. It reflects no deeper or more reactive an attitude toward an artist than one would have toward a bird whose song one finds particularly pleasing, or a car manufacturer whose cars one has been consistently satisfied with. My first response to such a skeptic is to wonder whether our experiences of art can really be as different as our words seem to reflect. Perhaps my descriptions of the attitudes and judgments I mean to refer to have highlighted aspects of these phenomena in misleading ways. For I, too, focus on and even get immersed in the experience of the artworks themselves. What attitudes I have towards the artists are, in most contexts, of secondary interest and often go by unnoticed. Nor do I mean to claim that the tendency to form reactive attitudes or even judgments awarding more or less aesthetic credit to artists is universal among art lovers, or that people who sometimes form such attitudes and judgments form them in connection with every artist whose work they appreciate. Some works of art and some individual artworks are more apt to evoke such reactive attitudes than others. Some artworks express a point of view or an emotional experience that one naturally takes to be a reflection, if not an intentional communication, of a person's soul. Other works, either more purely sensual or more purely cerebral, are less likely to be seen as outpourings of a unique human sensibility. Furthermore, different people engage with the arts for different reasons. They look for and receive different kinds of rewards. In speaking of the phenomena that I take to reflect a tendency to see artists as aesthetically responsible, then, I have no wish to make normative, much less universal, judgments about how people should experience art. It's enough for my purposes to bring attention to the fact that many people do respond to art in this way. If the skeptic doesn't find such experiences in himself, he can consider the reactions of others. It is important to me, however, that such reactions be legitimate. So I do need to respond to objections that charge that the tendency to regard artists as aesthetically responsible for their artworks is in some way wrong or misguided. Two sorts of objections seem especially likely: one epistemic, the other aesthetic. The first objection concerns the thought that the judgments and attitudes we form towards artists on the basis of their artworks are frequently based on assumptions that are epistemically unsound. Who has not been tempted to infer from a particularly realistic and insightful novel or film that the events portrayed by the novelist or filmmaker must be partly autobiographical? Many of us may also tend to assume that in order for emotions to be effectively conveyed in a piece of music or a poem, they must have been experienced by the artist herself. Or even that an actor who convincingly portrays intelligence must be intelligent. Or that one who excels in portraying psychologically twisted characters must be somewhat twisted himself. To the charge of inferring more about the lives and characters of artists from their artworks than is warranted, I plead guilty. I often make unsound leaps from artists' work to their lives and personalities, and I'm often proved wrong. But such inferences are not a necessary part of attributions of aesthetic responsibility, and these are not the attitudes and judgments I am concerned to defend. The judgments and attitudes that constitute attributions of aesthetic responsibility can be, and often are, narrow. They presuppose that the aesthetic qualities of the artwork come from the artist in a way that is more than merely causal, but they need not assume that they show anything more about him than that he had it in him psychologically to create this very work. Even this, however, a critic might object, is apt to be an ungrounded assumption. Who knows which aesthetically relevant features an artist put into her work on purpose, as opposed to ones that appear in the work accidentally? Sometimes, it's true, an artist leaves notes or gives an interview that tells us what went through her mind. Sometimes an artist makes clear in a work's title what she thinks the work is about. But often she doesn't. And when artists do speak about what they take their work to mean, or about what they find aesthetically significant about it, their remarks are often disappointingly vague, pretentious, or full of spiritual gibberish. So here's one. Yeah. Okay. Moreover, and here the epistemic objection blends into an aesthetic one, why should we care about what the artist put into her work non-accidentally in the first place? Isn't it better to just look or listen to the works themselves, to see what we can find in them independently of the artist's intentions? For an artist doesn't have privileged access to or authority over the meaning or the value of her work. The fact that an artist intends her work to express something is no guarantee that her work succeeds in doing so, nor does the fact that an artist didn't intend her work to express something mean that it doesn't express it nonetheless. To the charge that our tendency to regard artists as aesthetically responsible for their art encourages us to accept inaccurate images of the artists, we now add the objection that this tendency encourages a regrettable approach to appreciating and understanding the art. This second criticism is a form of the intentional fallacy. A critique, especially to an approach to literary interpretation, given prominence by William Wimsatt and Monroe Beardsley in the 1950s. Though I'm largely sympathetic to the core of Wimsatt and Beardsley's position, their criticisms are often understood in ways that seem to me unacceptably broad. Specifically, although the fallacy that Wimsatt and Beardsley argue for is literally and eponymously directed at the idea that an artist's intentions are of key importance to a correct understanding of her work, the objection is frequently interpreted as a rejection of the tendency to connect the meaning and significance of an artwork with the artist's psychology altogether. The broad interpretation of the intentional fallacy, as well as the aesthetic objection to criticisms of aesthetic responsibility I formulated a moment ago, blur the distinction between the question of whether an aesthetic feature of a work reflects the artist's intentions and the question of whether it is the product of the artist's psychology more generally. And though I agree with Wimsatt and Beardsley that emphasis on the former question, the question of intention, is usually a bad strategy for the appreciation of art, to utterly dismiss the latter question, whether it's a reflection of the artist's psychology, seems to me, with respect to a great deal of art, disastrous. For the fact that an artist did not intend to communicate what in fact the art calls up does not imply that what the artwork evokes doesn't come from the artist in some significant way. We can easily imagine a songwriter, for example, saying, "I didn't mean to write a sad song," while simultaneously acknowledging that the sadness that is there is an unintentional manifestation of something he felt. I tried to be careful in characterizing aesthetic responsibility to describe the assumed connection between an artist's psychology and the aesthetic features of her work in vague terms. I said that it is a condition of holding an artist aesthetically responsible in this way that the features be non-accidental, that when we credit or form a reactive attitude to the artist on the basis of her artwork, we presuppose that it shows something about the artist, namely, that the artist had it in her to create precisely this work. But I deliberately avoided any talk of an artist's intentions, decisions, and choices, or any suggestion that the artist would know, much less be in a position to say, exactly what he was doing aesthetically or why. We're too familiar with the stories of artists whose poetry, paintings, or songs were composed when they were on drugs or in dreamlike states, or others who talk about being taken over by their muses and of the mysteries of the creative process to expect or assume that all the aesthetic features of a work to which we respond are the result of an artist's intentions. But this doesn't stop us from crediting the artist with the particular aesthetic vision that is realized in her artwork. To deny that it matters to our understanding and appreciation of art, whether an artwork reflects an artist's psychology at all, would commit one to the view that it's irrelevant even that an artwork is a product of a human or other intelligent sensibility. It would imply that it is or should be irrelevant to one's experience of an interestingly shaped piece of stone, whether it was sculpted by a human agent or shaped by the forces of wind and rain. That it is or should be irrelevant to one's experience of a set of words on a page, whether it was composed by a poet or was rather, as some fanciful philosophical essays would have us imagine, the product of a monkey randomly plunking on a keyboard. Recalling examples I brought up earlier, it would imply that it shouldn't matter to our experience of a painting whether it was done by a person or an elephant, or to our experience of a piece of music, whether it was composed by a human or a machine. At least one influential theorist of art, Clive Bell, advocated this radical doctrine. His extreme doctrine of aesthetic formalism claimed that the only thing of aesthetic significance in the visual arts was significant form, defined as combinations of lines and colors that provoke a distinctive aesthetic emotion. For Bell, the aesthetic qualities of a painting do not even depend on whether the painting is representational, or, if the painting is representational, on what it represents. Indeed, Bell goes so far as to say that representation in a painting is at best a distraction. But this is an absurd thing to say of Hopper's Nighthawks, or Fra Angelico's Annunciation, or a late Rembrandt self-portrait. Part of what it is to appreciate these paintings is to recognize the sense of human isolation, of beatific serenity, and of psychological insight that is inextricable from seeing these paintings as the evocative artworks they are. If it is not literally impossible to see paintings in this way without assuming that they were produced non-accidentally by human beings, it is at least a distraction rather than an aid to appreciation to try to suppress or deny this assumption. If we turn to literature, the idea that the author or poet is irrelevant to literary interpretation is even more obviously outrageous. For the very recognition of the marks on the page or the sounds on the audio tape as words, much less as metaphors and puns, character sketches and plots, presupposes that they are products of a human intelligence, and indeed of a human intelligence equipped with a culturally and historically specific language. At any rate, few aestheticians would go so far as Bell. Even Wim's Beardsley admit that a poem does not come into existence by accident. The words of a poem come out of a head, not out of a hat. Clarifying the assumptions on which the according of aesthetic responsibility rests should, I believe, put both the epistemic and the aesthetic objection to our tendency to regard artists as aesthetically responsible to rest. The assumption that the aesthetic features of artworks show something about their artists, though falsifiable, seems innocent enough. And if that assumption, along with one's experience of a work, grounds an impulse to credit or feel affection or distaste for an artist, so be it. Still, those who don't find such a tendency in themselves might continue to feel uncomfortable, suspicious that those who do have such a tendency are likely to come to art for the wrong reasons and to experience art in a less than optimal way. Again, let me emphasize that I have no wish to make any normative claims about the appreciation of art. I don't mean to suggest that people ought, consciously and deliberately, to regard artists as aesthetically responsible, much less that the point of art is to give you insight into the artist's soul or to put you in a relationship with him, giving you results that would be more efficiently and straightforwardly achieved by reading the artist's autobiography or just taking him to lunch. It's rather that for many consumers of art, including myself, we just do automatically and spontaneously regard artists as aesthetically responsible for their art. We cannot help but experience much art as the non-accidental product of an intelligent artist, sometimes as a reflection of the artist's soul, or as an expression of the artist's point of view, or of her distinctive aesthetic vision. If we particularly admire or even love the work of art, we may naturally find ourselves crediting and feeling grateful to the artist. At the least, I've argued, such responses are typically unobjectionable, but for large categories of art, they are more than that. Leo Tolstoy, in his treatise on aesthetics, What is Art?, wrote that every work of art causes the receiver to enter into a certain kind of relationship, both with him who produced or is producing the art, and with all those who, simultaneously, previously, or subsequently, receive the same artistic impression. Speech, transmitting the thoughts and experiences of men, serves as a means of union among them, and art acts in a similar manner. The peculiarity of this latter means of intercourse being that whereas by words a man transmits his thoughts to another, by means of art he transmits his feelings. Although Tolstoy overgeneralized and overmoralized in presenting this claim as a universal norm, the continued appeal and popularity of his theory of art testifies to the fact that the kind of glimpse into another's heart and soul and the communion with the artist, as well as with other similarly responding appreciators of art, are among the deepest and most common rewards art has to offer. Another immensely important benefit of art is its ability to expand our knowledge and understanding of the range of human character and sensibility our world contains. Both such rewards are premised on the assumption that art is a reflection of what the artist feels, sees, and thinks. Both such rewards thus rely on the assumption that, in the sense I've been meaning to point out, artists are, at least commonly, aesthetically responsible for the aesthetic features of their artworks. But should we really refer to the phenomena I've been discussing as involving a kind of responsibility? Although the term seems natural, when introduced in some contexts, it may seem out of place or misleading in others. The word comes easily when contrasting the relationship of an artist to a canvas he painted with his relationship to one in which he clumsily knocked over some cans of paint. Or when explaining the shift in our attitudes when we discover that the artist of a strikingly colored painting was colorblind, or that the writer of an evocative string of words does not speak the language of the words he wrote down. There's an enormous difference between learning that an aesthetically interesting object, a visual or tactile form, or a series of words, or a set of musical notes, was painted or written or composed by a conscious human being, and learning that it came about by someone slipping on some paint, or copying words from a dictionary, or plunking random keys on a keyboard. And this difference affects our attitudes and judgments about both the object and its creator. It doesn't seem unnatural to express this difference by saying that in the first case, but not the second, we find the creator or artist responsible for the aesthetic features of her creation. And to say this is to suggest that there is a difference between merely causal responsibility and another kind, which is deeper. But the patterns according to which we form and withdraw attitudes and judgments towards artists on the basis of their artworks are in some ways quite different from those which characterize our practices of according moral responsibility. And when we focus on these differences, we may find the idea that they are both forms or expressions of responsibility more confusing than helpful. In particular, it's commonly thought that whether a person is morally responsible for something depends on whether he could have done otherwise, or on whether he had control of his behavior, or on whether he knew what he was doing. If a person is morally responsible, it's been said, he should be able to explain or justify his behavior. It is at the least appropriate to ask him to do so, He is answerable for what he has done. As I pointed out earlier, however, we apply no such conditions in cases of aesthetic responsibility. We don't expect Shakespeare or Cézanne or Mozart to be able to explain their choices of words, lines, and notes. And the question of whether they could have done otherwise, written different plays, painted different paintings, composed different symphonies, seems utterly beside the point in determining what attitudes to have to these artists on the basis of their art. Focusing on these contrasts may make us think that the attitudes we form towards artists on the basis of their artwork, even the attitudes of credit, are not really manifestations of a belief in anything properly called responsibility. We admire Shakespeare, certainly, for his richly insightful, clever, and moving plays, but it sounds odd to say that we hold him responsible for these works. Those familiar with the philosophical literature on responsibility may have heard of a distinction introduced by the philosopher Gary Watson between two senses of responsibility, both different from and deeper than causal responsibility, that Watson called attributability and accountability. According to Watson, we invoke the attributability sense when, by saying X is responsible for Y, we mean to attribute Y to X, in the sense that we take Y to show something about X, to be disclosive of X's self. In other instances, Watson reminds us, we use the expression to say that X may be held accountable for Y. If Y is bad, this would justify our blaming X or punishing him, or expecting him to explain, apologize, or compensate the victim for Y's effects. The idea that an individual must be in control of something in order for him to be responsible for it makes sense if one is thinking of responsibility as accountability, but not perhaps in connection with attributability. The question of whether we should think of responsibility as actually having these two senses, rather than one sense or three or even more, is a matter of much debate. I don't want to enter into this debate here, but Watson's distinction may be useful in helping us understand the ambivalence or confusion some might have toward the idea of aesthetic responsibility. For once the distinction is articulated, it seems clear that my discussion of aesthetic responsibility, that my discussion anyway, had attributability rather than accountability in mind. Indeed, as I've been using the phrase, to say that an artist is aesthetically responsible for her art is simply to say that the work can be attributed to her in a deeper or stronger than a merely causal sense, that it has a stronger and more personal connection to her than a mere causal connection would imply, that it comes from her and says something about her, that it is disclosive of herself. It's relatively unimportant whether one wants to use the word responsibility to refer to this connection, though unfortunately, to substitute talk of attributability here would bring problems of its own. One problem is that the word is so vague and colorless that it gives no indication of a difference between attributing something to an individual and simply predicating it of her, and mere predication is much too broad to capture what is intended by the term. The other is that, in the domain of art in particular, attribution already has a fixed and different meaning. To attribute a work of art to an artist is simply to identify him as the person who created it, as opposed to students in his workshop or others in his school. In any case, I believe that our ambivalence and confusion about how to refer to and think about the phenomena that manifests what I've been calling aesthetic responsibility shows us something about both the concepts that philosophers discuss and about the relation of these concepts to our lives and self-understanding. So let me conclude by pointing out a couple of the lessons that I think can be learned from these reflections. One lesson can be learned, or at least reinforced, is that the concept of deep, not merely causal responsibility is not as clear or as clean as many people take or want it to be. There are some contexts in which the term seems apt for thinking about the relation between artists and their artworks, other contexts in which it seems inappropriate, even though one's referring to the very same relation. As I've mentioned, one way philosophers deal with this distinguishes different kinds of responsibility, including at least responsibility as attributability and responsibility as accountability. Another, or perhaps only a verbal variant of that first one, understands responsibility to refer only to accountability and treats the notion of attributability as an independent concept. Though I don't favor one of these approaches over the other, thinking about the phenomena that I've been referring to as indications of aesthetic responsibility gives added reason to think that some such distinction or clarification in that ballpark is necessary for understanding our talk of responsibility. But attributability itself, if it is meant to refer to a substantial and interesting relation between individuals and their actions, properties, and effects, is far from well understood. Earlier, following Watson, I characterized it as having to do with a disclosure or reflection of a self. But what is a self? On what basis do we or should we regard beings as having or being selves, as opposed to just being creatures or objects of other sorts? Can a robot be or have a self? What about a chicken? An infant? A 2-year-old? And on what basis do we or should we decide what is part of someone's self and what is alien to it? Strawson's discussion of the contrast between reactive attitudes and the objective attitude that I mentioned earlier in the lecture is suggestive in this context, for there's something plausible in the idea that the only kinds of creatures to whom we find it reasonably to robustly attribute things, that is, the only kinds of beings that we tend to think of as having sufficiently complex, intelligent, and sensitive selves, are the ones to whom we find it appropriate to have reactive attitudes. Moreover, this thought seems equally plausible in connection with aesthetic cases as it does in connection with the moral ones. We don't have reactive attitudes to elephant painters, to typing monkeys, to finger painting toddlers, but we do, or at least we may, to Jackson Pollock or Virginia Woolf. Remembering that Strawson also connects the appropriateness of the reactive attitudes with the potential for involvement or participation with others in interpersonal human relationships, suggests that the task of understanding what it is to be or to have a self is closely related to the task of understanding what it is to be distinctively human. It's perhaps with respect to this question that attention to the phenomena I've been discussing today can be most philosophically useful. As a corrective to an unduly narrow identification of humanity, that is what it is to be human, with rational agency that has dominated philosophical thought. When we ask what it takes to be human, understanding this as a broadly ethical rather than a scientific and biological question, the first thing that leaps out at us tends to be our intelligence, which we have to a higher degree than any other creatures with whom we are acquainted. Historically, we've tended to identify intelligence with the capacity to reason, the ability to think abstractly, and the ability to use language. These, in turn, have led to our ability to justify our beliefs and actions to ourselves and to others, and our abilities to act in accordance with laws we give to ourselves and with values we endorse. No doubt these abilities play a large role in what makes us, as a class, especially interesting and important to each other. They're essential to our ability to engage in scientific inquiry and in our ability to be moral agents. But our experience of art, at least the experience of some of us, of the experience of some art, as well as the urge to make art, which I've barely touched on in this paper, also suggests or points to features that make us especially interesting and important to each other. When we ask ourselves what kinds of individuals might be capable of what I'm calling aesthetic responsibility, we're unlikely to focus on quite the same traits and capacities or to identify the same range of creatures. It seems possible to imagine rational creatures, perhaps extraterrestrials or very advanced machines, who lack the capacity to create or appreciate anything we can recognize as art. And to imagine, if not actually find, individuals who do create significant art, even though they lack the deliberative powers and self-control that would be needed to regard them as fully morally responsible agents. The importance of art in people's lives, both the drive to create it and the passion to experience it, is a remarkable fact of human life, universal across place and time and culture. Arguably, it is as much a mark of the human as is the use of language. Presumably, part of why art moves or speaks to us so strongly is that through art, we can discover and make contact with the emotions, experiences, thoughts, and perspectives of other human souls. Thinking about what it takes to create art that we respond to in this way, as opposed to what might fortuitously bring about an interesting or appealing array of words, sounds, or shapes, and also perhaps about what it takes to be responsive to the art of others, can thus provide clues to what it is to be human, of what it is to be a self or a soul like us, that are very different from what one gets when one... Sorry, I can't read my own writing. When one takes the paradigm of what it is to be human to be the ability to engage in moral deliberation. Thinking along these lines, then, is apt to highlight a somewhat different set of faculties, abilities, and sensitivity from those we notice when we take the paradigm of human activity to be deliberative and rational action. Insofar as we cherish those qualities that makes us capable of aesthetic responsibility as well as moral responsibility, and those faculties that drive us to create art as well as science, it is important that we not neglect these qualities and faculties in our educational practices, our social policies, or our philosophical theories about what it is to be human. That's the end.
Professor Wolf will take questions from the audience. And
shall
I choose people? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want this on?
It doesn't matter. We could turn, if there are more lights on, we could turn.
Mute the whole thing in enough. Case you want to bring it back up.
Yeah. Back. Well, if we need a slide, we can go back to it.
But do that, and then you can just go back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Ah, okay. Well, there's only a few. There's only the ones in the front, but yeah, good. Yeah.
Does that sound good?
Yeah. If there are any students who want to ask questions.
Usually there are.
Yeah. Okay.
You've got a standing room only.
I know. And they stayed, maybe for the food.
Well,
right.
We didn't know about the food.
Oh,
so
okay.
Now
right. Now there's, that's why they're here.
Now
anyway, it's very nice. Maybe we can have them sit down while they're.
Okay. So I'm assuming that all the young people in the back want to, or they're so excited that they want to stay standing up.
There are lots of seats now. So,
there are lots of seats in case you want.
Yeah.
Okay, so as is our practice, we'll take questions, preferably from a student first and foremost.
No. what I was talking about in the lecture was aesthetic responsibility, that is to say, responsibility that wasn't moral, responsibility for the aesthetic features of our artwork that just evoked aesthetic reactions. But it seems to me that the kinds of cases you're talking about are cases in which the issue is, are they morally responsible for the aesthetic features of their artwork? And that's not a question that I meant to be weighing in on. I guess my default assumption is you're morally responsible for whatever you do, and if you're creating artwork, you're morally responsible for that. But that seems to be a moral issue that they're talking about in connection with what they're doing. Does that seem wrong to you? Right. It's a big and, to my mind, fascinating debate in aesthetics, how the aesthetic qualities of a work relate and interact with the ethical qualities. And so I don't have a settled view on this. I think there is there's a good case to be made for saying that they interact, though I don't think they interact in any very clear and simple way. So, to the question, can you separate them? I'm inclined to say no, certainly not completely and cleanly. But you can ask different questions about them, namely, morally, is it all right to produce this work? Is it all right to release this work? That's one kind of question. And then there's the question of what does the work disclose about the artist, which is not necessarily a moral question. Maybe I'm confused about what you have in mind by what the Straussonian dropout is. Yes. Right. These seem to me much more naturally connected. So my understanding of Strawson is that, one of his great contributions was to suggest that we think of responsibility in terms of it's a concept behind what makes these attitudes appropriate. That is, being an appropriate object of attitudes like resentment, gratitude, pride, contempt, etc., just is being responsible, having the status of responsible agency. And the interest we have in responsible agency is connected to the fact that that's what it is also to relate to someone as in interpersonal human relationships. So my thought is the fact that we also have these attitudes in connection with seeing someone's artistic creation, that we have reactive attitudes, shows that there's a kind of responsibility involved there, and also that it too is connected to what it, you know, being in the community of interpersonal, relatable selves. Right. So that was the connection I saw. So they seem very closely parallel to me.
Yeah. Artist, right. Because you're part of this relationship with that. And what that gets me thinking is it really the artist that we want a relationship with? Or is it something more like some kind of applied author, some kind of artist persona? There's a passage in one of Jennifer Robinson's essays, I don't remember exactly how it goes, but she's talking about Tolstoy.
Well, I think I agree with the motives behind what you're saying. And therefore agree with something about what you're saying. I don't understand why people talk about that in terms of an implied or hypothetical author. It's a real person who wrote this book. So I just don't. So on the one hand, I guess I want to say, look, when I say, you said it's not the real person you want a relationship with. To which my answer is, I mean, most of the time at least, well, the only relationship I want with that person is to read his books. I don't want any more of a relationship with him. I don't even want to know more about him, much less to call him up or anything. So it's not, so all I want is the relationship I have with him by reading his books. That said, to say, well, I don't want a relationship with him, I want a relationship of some implied construct, I can't really process that carefully. I mean, what kind of relationships do we want with our colleagues? You all have your own colleagues, but, you know, right? I mean, there are a few people in the world where I want a relationship with that person in all their parts, but most people, not so much, you know? And so to say, I only want the relationship as a philosophical interlocutor, there's nothing implied. It's just that's the part of them that I care about. Yeah. Right. And the narrator and the omniscient narrator, all of them. Well, so I mean, there's something about that way of talking that I just am not processing right. I mean, I'm familiar with it. I think I read Anna Karenina. I relate to the characters and the narrator of Anna Karenina. I don't need yet another fictional character. So really my point is more connected to the thought that if I thought that was a random set of letters plunked on a keyboard, I couldn't relate to it the way I do relate to it. Therefore, it's essential to me to see it as a product of an intelligence. That's really all I need, I think.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about attributability, you talk about coming from the artist, saying something about the artist, disclosure of self to the artist. And I guess I'm inclined to think that it fits with the first coming thing. It comes from the artist. To be aesthetically responsible for this work, the artist must have been in a certain psychological state, have a certain set of abilities for this to be possible, for it to come from us, or to get credit for it. But I'm also inclined to think that it says something or anything about her soul or herself beyond that. And that's largely because there are so many shitty people who do amazing art, amazing music that moves us, not just aesthetically, moves us morally. And, you know, you think there's a warm Tolstoy, and then you find out...
The actual Tolstoy.
Yeah. Right. So maybe there's a piece of Tolstoy's soul or herself that's warm. That's not that interesting. Not that exciting.
Well, so again, I guess I think the only attribute we know the artist has from the artist's work is the attribute of having created the work. If it's a work with great moral insight, it shows that the artist has great moral insight enough to create that work. It doesn't mean that she lives by that moral insight. Woody Allen is an example that comes to mind easily. So I guess I don't think it, unlike you, I don't think the fact that I discover that somebody whose work moves me morally, that is, with great moral insight. Dickens also was a terrible husband, apparently. I was sorry to have to learn. I'm sorry to tell those of you. Like, I love Dickens, but I... Huh? Yeah. Like, there's so many cases of disillusion there. But I think, to say it's not very interesting if it's just that he could put it into his work, I think it's fascinating, actually, that a person can understand and appreciate so much and at the same time not behave in better ways. So I don't think it's not... And it's also true of a lot of great art that moves me by terrible human beings. It's just not a moral... We're moved by things that aren't... They're neither moral nor immoral. When I look at Matisse, I don't think about ethics at all, right? I guess I think people are complicated. In some ways, looking at the cases of artists might make that more obvious to us than when we meet people in day-to-day life and try to... And we think we know them because we see one part of them, but in fact, there's more to them. So I guess I don't feel that way. And then to the thought, well, maybe a machine could have written War and Peace or Portrait of a Lady. That would... If that were true, I would have to revise my views. I don't see how that could happen. if it did, I would either change my views of Portrait of a Lady or would have to just say I was totally wrong, you know, been empirically disproved. Well, I have two thoughts in response. One is I should be clear, it doesn't necessarily mean appreciating it less. It doesn't, so there isn't necessarily a better or worse. The claim I wanted to make is that I appreciate it differently. That is, when I see it as produced by, by a human being. I mean, you could take as a totally different kind of example. You walk into a room and there's a beautiful vase of flowers on the table and you think, that's beautiful. And then as you get closer, or maybe you actually have to touch it to say, oh, they're silk, they're not natural flowers. That changes my aesthetic response. Not necessarily better or worse. I mean, it might vary, whether it's better or worse or just different, but it's different. And when I think this was written by a human being or sculpted by a human being versus this was found on the... So even non-representational things, I tend to look at it differently. I'll ask different questions. I'll attend to different things. That seems to me to be appropriate and reasonable. But the other thing I wanted to say is just that as I mentioned a couple times in the paper, I don't want to say there's only one right way to appreciate art and that a person who says, look, I see this play as a play about, you know, about mortality and when I read some, you know, when I read about its creation and it turns out that was, you know, that's not what the author meant, that the author wasn't even using the same, you know, words in the same way. It doesn't matter. I'm still going to see it that way because that's how I saw it and it worked for me. There is a reasonable philosophical debate about whether we should say that's fine, different, you know, different strokes for different folks, or whether we should say no, there's a right way, and it either does or doesn't involve us. I didn't want to get into the debate about the right way. I was just thinking this is one way a lot of people respond to art. I think a lot of people, and where if I find out that it couldn't have possibly been what the artist had in there, again, intended isn't the word, but like the artist had no conception of this, then when I see it differently. And that seems not crazy or mistaken.
Way in which we see certain things as just events in the world and certain things as deeds, and to see it as a deed is to see that it bears some relation to some kind of agent that stands behind it, and that already it puts me in a certain sort of relationship with that agent. I see the agency as expressed in what is done, or something like that. So I was just wondering, it seemed interesting to me that same kind of structure, and he said, look, this is sort of true of anything that's involved with speech, right? I mean, when words are spoken. So I was just curious what this third notion of responsibility, what's specifically aesthetic about it, or if it has a just sort of much more broad application, very just due to the way we sort of respond to things that are sort of produced by agents.
So let me just ask you, when you say the third, what were the first two?
The causal and moral.
Oh, okay. So, all right, so if I was saying, look, there's people distinguish causal and moral, and now you're adding a third, what's so special about the third? Right. What's aesthetic about the third? Okay. Nothing. So, so I mean, aesthetic responsibility, the subject I was talking about, or the it's not so much a subject or a kind of responsibility. The range of cases I was giving were aesthetic in that they were responses to the aesthetic features of an art maker, right? So they were just cases that were all cases of aesthetic responsibility. But really the point that was kind of driving the project was not to say there's a third kind of responsibility. It was rather to say philosophers, and maybe more than philosophers, distinguish between causal and moral responsibility. That's the wrong distinction. The distinction is between superficial and deep responsibility, causal responsibility being identifiable to superficial in the sense that anything can create something, I mean, including a horde of beetles or a rainstorm, or can be causally responsible for some dead trees. And the contrast is between that and something deeper. And so moral responsibility is one range of cases, right? But aesthetic responsibility is another range of cases, and philosophical responsibility or carpentry response, I mean, they're all, yes. So that's really what I was getting at. So I appreciate that. I need to make it clearer that I wasn't trying to say I found a third kind. I do want to say something actually even broader than that. You said it's really about the distinction between a doer, between agents and events. One of the things that I find interesting about aesthetic responsibility and about other things is that it doesn't even have to be agent. It has to be a self. So events, sometimes we do things that disclose ourselves. Some of those things that we do are actions. They disclose ourselves for sure. But or some of them do. But sometimes they're uncontrollable reactions that disclose ourselves. So I mentioned senses of humor. That's not just about who can tell, you know, what jokes they tell, but what they can't help but laugh at, or what they find funny and don't find funny. And those aren't actions at all, but those are also disclosive. Okay.
Mm-hmm. They have no idea what that will for.
Yes.
Or if their programmer writes a program. And if these cases, to me it seems they can't really have attributability either because the person can't ever foresee what it creates or what it stirs in other people. If these aren't cases where there exists attributability, how can we say the same thing about human mind under the influence of drugs, or even human mind where the person can't explain how they actually made this, what drove them to it? Since they're both.
Well, it's a good question, and especially because there's actually, you know, a lot of art and music that intentionally does this. They intentionally do something that will yield an unpredictable or random set of sounds or lines or whatever. And so one question, so there is a question, what should we say about aesthetic responsibility in those cases? I should think what we'd say is that there is aesthetic responsibility in those cases to come up with the idea of doing that, right? So John Cage can say, I know what I'll, you know, let's create a work that consists of everybody just listening to the sounds in the concert hall that, you know, which could be some coughs, some rustling of candy wrappers, right? He doesn't know what it's going to be, right? So it was his idea to do that, but beyond that, the quality of the experience, the aesthetic quality of the experience you get, you can't attribute to anyone. So that's, I think, what happens. But now you said, well, isn't that also true of a human being insofar as they're not, they don't really know what they're doing or why they're doing it? Well, I guess I don't think that's true, though I'm be willing to hear more, because it's not, I guess I think it's not random, it's not accidental. I mean, what the things that I do, there is, they might have a unity, they might express a vision. It's just not a vision that I have kind of the higher level control and understanding of. I mean, even philosophy, I have to say, when I write a philosophy paper, and that's a very intentional activity. Maybe there are people who write philosophy papers on drugs, but that would be a very different kind of. Maybe we can all decide which of the papers we've read. But in a way, I know what I'm doing, and I'm writing each word and revising each word on purpose. But there's a sense in which I feel like it's not till the fifth time I've presented the paper that I know what I was really trying to say. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which was the actual theme of the painting. Is that
yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So my point is that isn't it because it captured the theme in the painting and not actually the painter itself? Since that induction seems to hold, isn't it so that
well, the viewer is responsible for what he goes out and does afterwards. Is that right? It's actually an interesting question. There are cases and cases in which you might think an artist who could predict that it would have this effect on viewers has a certain responsibility for, whether to do that or not. But in any case, it's a nice case because the suggestion is, all right, the viewer is responsible. If he goes out and commits a murder as a result of this, he's responsible for the murder, right? Not the artist, right? So now the thought is, if you just admire the work and think, and it makes you think of, man's inhumanity to man or something, again, it's not the work, it's not the artist that's responsible, it's the viewer. Is that the thought? I'm not sure I have any need to disagree with that, really. I mean, it's not that kind of... When I was thinking... I wasn't thinking the artist is responsible for the viewer's responses so much as thinking that when a viewer responds to art, when certain kinds of viewers respond to certain kinds of art in a certain way, they are holding the person responsible, not for their responses, but for the vision that they put out on the canvas, or they're holding them responsible for that, right? But of course, what that means is going to be filtered through my response. Right. I guess this actually seems to connect to the initial question about whether they should be held morally responsible for it. And sometimes. Yeah.
Okay. I think that I went to an aesthetics conference recently, and there was a whole session on the aesthetics of food. So I don't think we're ending our investigation if we thank people.
Thank you.